Good morning. And I thank you for my 88th birthday wishes. I'll tell you what this is all about later. The other night I saw a movie written by Neville Shoup. World War II, the politicians and the generals went crazy. They threw bombs, atomic bombs, and they radiated the entire world with radiation dust. In a matter of months, the entire population of the earth disappeared. We are now facing something like that, not as radical, but it sure as heck makes a point. We have to do something to protect the earth. And if you'll bear with me, I'll tell you some of the things that are being done. In 1941, a Japanese admiral stood on the bridge of an aircraft carrier and watched scores of Zero aircraft take off for Hawaii for a day of infamy. He reportedly said, "I'm afraid we have left the tiger out of his cage." He was right. The tigers were the increased mobilization and industrialization of the U.S. industry. As production increased, as did the pollution of the air, the water, and the environment. Excuse me. It's sealed. In the spring of 1943, the first major air pollution incident occurred in the Los Angeles basin. Orange County is part of that basin. Formerly called the Valley of the Smokes by Native Americans because the inversion layers that trapped the pollutants in the air at ground level. Add the trapped pollutants to 200 days of beautiful sunshine. Welcome to California. 200 days of bright sunlight. Pollution from cars, trucks, power plants, refineries, industrial and residential dwellings, all of these pollutants cook up in the heat and the sunlight to create a ozone, a long, lung-burning form of oxygen. Particles in the air are not dispersed by the weak ocean breezes or the easterly winds. The average Angelenos, sorry, Orange County. The average Angelino's eyes will water, noses will run, breathing problems will occur. Exercise at schools is forbidden when the ozone count rises above 70 parts per billion. Keep that number in mind, 70 parts per billion. By 1969, the Los Angeles basin was not a healthy place to live or even raise a family. In other parts of the United States, water pollution was a major problem. Rivers in Cleveland, Boston, and New York, and along the Mississippi were so contaminated with pollutants and disease that no viable life, not even leeches and slug worms, would live. Rivers and streams in many industrial cities, including Cleveland and Boston, caught fire. Can you imagine waking up one morning and the Orange River running fire? Well, we've gotten rid of all of that. These came from industrial waste discharges, causing thousands of dollars of damage to government and private properties. The waste flushed down toilets, drains, and public waterways needed a different approach. The Clean Water Act was enacted in 1972 to provide new anti-pollution registration, regulations, enforcement, millions of dollars in grants to construct, and publicly owned sewage plants. It is now possible to swim in most of the lakes and rivers in the United States without fear of personal contagion, disease, poisons, or parasites. In addition, wastewater plants were built to reuse water. This little lovely bottle of holy water from Toledo, Ohio, comes out of Lake Erie. In 1943, if you drank water out of Lake Erie, undiluted, your family should have had an insurance policy for you. In most areas in the United States now, including Orange County, there are plants that take contaminated waste, run it through all sorts of filters and oxygenation, and somewhere along the line, you're going to be drinking this stuff. And it's good for you. It's actually clearer than you get out of the wells down below. From 1943 to 1947, as the vehicle count in Los Angeles Basin rose and more industry flooded into the area, there were over more than 200 days of significant air pollution episodes. Ozone in excess of 70 parts per billion created episodes where hospitals received many more people coming in with breathing problems. The kids were not allowed to play outside after school, and many of the high school football games were canceled. In some cases, on certain days, the ozone rose to 90 parts per million. On those days, had it gone to 100 or 1.0, we would have shut down the whole county from Ventura to San Diego. For some strange reason, at 96, it stopped. I was working that day. For some strange reason, politically, it never went above 96. You got the word. I joined the Los Angeles Air Pollution Control District in 1956 as an inspector. And over the next 40 years, I enforced air pollution regulations enacted by the County Board of Supervisors, the California Air Resources Board, the federal EPA, and with that, APCD, which was Los Angeles only. The other three counties were not involved. Los Angeles County required all stationary sources of air pollution to apply and take out permits. Using this system, air pollution devices were installed, some sources were prohibited, and many hundreds of chemicals were banned or restricted from use. Ladies, look at the nail polish you have today. It's not the nail polish you used when you were 12 years old. It's entirely different. California Air Resources Board enacted regulations to prohibit smoking vehicles, set new standards for vehicle engines, prohibited lead gasoline. That's why your spark plugs last 100,000 miles now instead of 10. Reformulated gasoline in the summer months and required catalytic mufflers on all new vehicles. These and many other things that were done locally, these actions indicated that the clean air saved millions of lives. 1958, I was transferred to the industrial cities of Vernon and the City of Industry. These cities had and have the highest concentrations of potential sources of air pollution, such as steel foundries, magnesium foundries, aluminum foundries, meat packers, chemical plants, meat rendering, I'll explain that deal later, and a plethora of small manufacturing plants. In addition to continuing my university education funded by EPA, thank you, Mr. Nixon, I was getting an education enforcing new technologies. In addition to the technology, I was learning a heck of a lot about industry. And at school, I was getting an MBA to understand it even more. My next assignment was to help or close pollution nuisance sources emanating from closed or operating landfills, what you normally would call a garbage dump. Some of these dumps contained oil residue from the refineries in the area. And people living close to these landfills because of poor zoning restrictions would smell gasoline, oil, and God knows what else in the evening hours. The opportunity for me to move about was educationally satisfying and very profitable as I rose up the promotion ladder. Retiring as manager of industrial enforcement at AQMD and later as chief of enforcement for the counties of Ventura and San Diego. There's a couple of counties next door to us, Riverside and San Bernardino, and these folks were not happy in the ensuing years and complained loudly to the California Air Resources Board that LA was not doing its part in preventing the high quantities and quality of air pollution from drifting east into their counties. On July 1st, 1977, the California Air Resources merged LA, Riverside, San Bernardino, and Los Angeles into one agency, now known as the South Coast Air Quality Management District. This permitted equal enforcement, equal permitting, rather than some of the helter-skelter that was going on in some of the other counties. In 1982, I was reassigned to San Diego, and in 1988 to Ventura, to bring a more professional, aggressive enforcement program to these counties. A great deal of work went into bringing the federal authorities into compliance because they initially stated they were exempt from the laws of California. We are the federals. We are the military. We took them to court, and they laid down and did whatever we asked them to do. Southern California air quality has improved over the last 50 years, but still is not in compliance with the EPA standard of 70 parts per billion. Thanks to local industry working collaboratively with regulators to reduce emissions and having the most stringent regulations in the United States, we have reduced the excess days of exceeding 70 ppb. Most days are below 60. But the LA Basin still has the worst ozone pollution in the United States. Prior to this administration being elected, the EPA and California were working to reduce the ppb to 60 ppb, 60 parts per billion, with additional rules to control specific industries and motor vehicles. The new administration has put this project on hold. You have billionaires running the country who have no aspect or respect for the general population. On February 3rd of this year, President Trump ordered a dangerous and ignorant order to the EPA to dismantle the previous administration's landmark climate of effort, backing away from the aggressive plan to cut emissions at power plants and new oil well drilling. Activists in California and New York will fight back because these regulations had been the foundation of America's leadership in confronting global warming and air pollution. However, California and other states are way ahead of our leaders. And we are meeting the new compliance states set by the Trump order. Many of our leaders appear to be scientifically ignorant and therefore incapable of understanding the precipice we are approaching. This administration must accept the reality of climate change and pollution control before it is too late, for this, our Earth, our only home. And I thank you.
Dear Earth, I feel a bit silly writing you this way. After all, what address would I mail this letter to? Earth, on Earth Street, at all zip codes, planet Earth. And what's the point, really, of writing a letter to something that can't read it anyway? I suppose it's because you figure in all our lives in such a way that often goes unacknowledged. You've been there for all of us day in and day out, a source of constancy across the movement of time and space. Out of the cosmic miracle of the Big Bang, that mammoth explosion that sent matter and energy expanding in all directions, several billion years later, you, Earth, were formed. As Robert T. Weston says, time out of time, before time, in the vastness of space, Earth spun to orbit the sun. Earth with the thunder of mountains newborn, the boiling of seas. And millions of years later, out of those seas, prehistoric fish crawled out of the water to begin the evolutionary lineage that we sit atop today. When we search for a creator, someone or something to give thanks to for the very existence of humanity, we must thank you, O Earth, so often called Mother Earth, a reminder that you have indeed nurtured us as a parent, raised us up from the cradle to be who we are. There is no us, there would be no us without you. And if it's true, if that is true, it's important that we have a theological lens to look through in order to appreciate your gifts, Earth, especially here on Earth Day, a time when so many have marched for science, voicing their support for evidence-based policymaking, funding for scientific research, government transparency, and government acceptance of the scientific consensus on climate change evolution. Religious naturalism, that's a lens, a theological lens that invites us to respond to the world in ways that have traditionally been called religious. Religious naturalism embraces words like mystery and wonder, while also holding on to the realities of science. Historical roots of religious naturalism can be found in our Unitarian Universalist movement, people such as Henry David Thoreau and Transcendentalist Walt Whitman, to name two luminaries who lifted up nature's rhapsodies and sung the body electric. A religious naturalist is not so concerned with heaven or God, but instead focuses on the realities of this world, searching for meaning and possibility on this great sphere we call home. Religious naturalists look for sacred moments, and I don't use that word lightly, among everyday existence. Jerome Stone, a Unitarian Universalist minister and truly the foremost expert on religious naturalism, defines sacred as the word which we use to describe events, things, processes which are of overriding importance and yet are not under our control or within our power to manipulate. Let me share one of those sacred moments with you, one of my sacred moments. Once, after a long hike, I sat on a fallen log deep in one of your forests, Earth, a forest full of green leaves and mossy stumps and the buzz of insect life. I sat there reading a book. And as I turned the pages, I became aware that I was being watched. And from the corner of my eye, I saw a deer. Now, it was frozen, waiting, and I held my breath. Finally, determining I was preoccupied with my book and thus no threat, the deer gracefully crossed the clearing in front of me. I was in awe of her beauty there in this pristine spot where nature had been allowed to flourish. But this exhibition wasn't done. When the deer reached the other side, as though she gave a signal to the next one, then crossed another deer, and still another, and then another, tiptoeing across, certain that I was unaware of them, until I finally lost count. I kept my head down in my book, while those graceful creatures silently congratulated each other on their stealth adventure. They were watching me, those deer, and I happened to catch them, rewarded for just a moment by a glimpse into their world. But I wonder how often we don't catch them watching. Are they here? The deer and the tigers and the bears and butterflies and foxes and snakes to watch us? Are they your ambassadors, O Earth, your benevolent spies, always positioned to reflect back to us who we are? When ducks are covered in oil, birds strangled by plastic, and fish gasp for oxygen in polluted waters, they tell us that we have done you wrong. We Unitarian Universalists have a seventh principle, one that lifts up the interdependent web of all existence. We can think about this as our connection to the whole universe, but most of the time, I know for me, that whole universe thing is too big to comprehend. But we can comprehend our connection to the earth. Forrest Gilmore says, the interdependent web, expressed as the spirit of life, the ground of all beings, the oneness of all existence, the community forming power, the process of life, the creative force, even God, can help us develop that social understanding of ourselves that we and our culture so desperately need. It is a source of meaning to which we can dedicate our lives. And within this source of meaning, central to this interdependent web, is you, O Earth. I marvel at your wonders. The thunderstorms that fill the air with electricity when I was a kid in the Midwest, the tornadoes that inspire dread and awe, the earthquakes I have experienced in California, rumblings of your power, the stunning beauty of countless lakes and streams and rivers and waterfalls I have seen in my time, the oceans I have sailed upon and swam beneath alongside dolphins and manatees, the canyons and the deserts, the hills and the flatlands, the cities that have been built upon you, sometimes achingly beautiful and sometimes startlingly ugly. But you make no distinction in your hospitality. You are generous, letting us roam over your entire surface, letting us choose where our home will be, letting us use you even as we so often forget to show our gratitude. And there is no doubt we haven't shown our gratitude at many times, through countless times, innumerable times and ways throughout our history as human beings on this planet. Some have taken the words from Genesis at face value. After God made Adam and Eve, he blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Theologically, they have taken this to mean that we have dominion over the earth, that it is ours to take and use and exploit for what we will. And we're seeing that right now. As Al talked about, we see those in power who doubt the realities of the science of global warming and air pollution, those who allow pipelines to be built where the conscience of the people has said no, those who have destroyed environmental regulations in favor of big business. We are in a time where we cannot be complacent. Our earth needs us. And if we need proof that people with conscience are needed, we need look no further than the mirror of the natural world itself, the deer just out of the corner of our eyes watching us, reflecting back to us who we are. The countless animals suffering in the conditions of crowded industrial farms, reflecting back to us who we are. The mass of discarded plastic the size of Texas floating in the North Pacific Ocean, reflecting back to us who we are. The birds of the air who see all, who watch us, who know what we do, how we pollute or how we nurture, how we pay attention or how we ignore. And we in this liberal religious community recognize we're not called by nature or spirit or God or conscience or intellect to have dominion over the earth. We are called to be its caretakers. It's been here before any one of us, and hopefully will be here after any one of us. We are custodians, stewards of the earth. We are the earth's voice. And it is for us, of course, that this letter is truly intended. For earth, no matter how I may thank you, how I call to you, you cannot read this letter, you cannot take in these words, but we can. We're your ears and your voice, and we can and should be your watchers too. We should be your guardians, in touch with your sacred possibilities, the messages you give us, always present, but so often uncomprehended. Once I sat on the front porch of our house at twilight as it melted into night. And during that time, the cool west breeze blew in and the night came alive with sounds. It's this whole symphonic score of nighttime insects harmonizing to the beat of a cricket. The trees were silhouetted against a starry sky, and the ground smelled of earth of ancient times and the building blocks of nature. And in that moment, that everyday moment, I felt one with the earth. I was part of it. I felt my atoms and beings were older than my body and had been here before and would be here always in a different form. But here, I was energy and matter, a part of the great sweep of this stunningly beautiful planet. My mother discovered me on the porch, scolding me because it was long past my bedtime. There I was in my pajamas, at one with the earth. And how could I tell her it was important work I was doing, that I was communing with the ineffable, that I had pulled back the veil to see something greater than myself, something I was part of, a planet that was both my cradle and my grave, my sorrow and my hope. There were no words. And so I was whisked off to bed, and the moment was stored away in my memory, sometimes to be pulled out and dusted off as I tried to make sense of it, but always there, even as I became distracted with the drama of my own life and cell phones and what to have for dinner. Jerome Stone calls moments like this horizontal transcendence, a pointing beyond the self toward our connection to something greater, but still rooted firmly in the realities of this world. And through the religious naturalist perspective of paying deep attention to what happens in our lives, we find those moments of transcendence, not vertical transcendence that lifts us up to something beyond this world, but horizontal transcendence that profoundly marks and even changes us, but still leaves us located within the realm of this beautiful, complicated, mysterious, wondrous, and even fragile world. It's James Baldwin who said, "Nothing is fixed. Forever and forever it is not fixed. The earth is always shifting. The light is always changing. The sea does not cease to grind down rock. Generations do not cease to be born, and we are responsible to them because we are the only witnesses they have. The sea rises, the light fails, lovers cling to each other, and children cling to us. The moment we cease to hold each other, the moment we break faith with one another, the sea engulfs us, and the light goes out." So, dear Earth, in order to make sure that the sea does not engulf us and the light does not go out, I finish this letter to you in recognition that I have only ever been writing to all of us, as I said, for we are the Earth's stewards. We are your keepers. We are your hope and conscience amidst the eternal shifting. May we act accordingly. May we act with love. May we be keepers of this glorious home of ours amidst all the tumult we create. May we look for the sacred and see it in you. For when we do, we will know that we are seeing a reflection of ourselves, of how we have treated you, how we have cared for you, and how we have loved you. Sincerely, people of conscience. People of conscience and hope.